We think about meaningful work as work that is pays a family wage, a sustainable life, and is fulfilling. Fulfilling, where a person could say, this is my work, whatever it is, and I make a difference.
Welcome to Management Matters, a National Academy of Public Administration podcast where policy meets practice. I'm Terry Girton, president of the Academy. On this episode, I'll discuss how philanthropies can help connect individuals to meaningful work with my guest, Robin Kramer. Robin is an Academy Fellow, and she's currently the Managing Director at the Smit Foundation, which was founded by Harbor Freight Tools CEO Eric Smit in 2016. Robin, thanks so much for joining me today.
Delight to be with you.
Well, I first want to welcome you to the fellowship. You've got such a unique set of experiences and perspective on public administration. We are delighted to have you as a fellow of the Academy. And speaking of experiences, you were the first woman to serve as chief of staff to a mayor, actually two mayors of Los Angeles, Richard Reardon and Antonio Villaraigosa. Los Angeles itself is bigger than some countries. So what was your role like as chief of staff to the mayor?
You know, it's a terrific experience. Really, the role is three words: make everything work. And, you know, I worked for very hard-charging, very different kind of men, a Republican and a Democrat, which, you know, also proves that potholes are nonpartisan. There's really all kinds of roles. There's the role of connecting the dots of leadership, connecting the mayor's priorities for the city with the plans to achieve them, and seeing to it there's excellence in execution, communication to stay grounded, collaboration with the city council and community, and making sure there's the right kind of pathways for the city's advocacy in Sacramento and DC. And there's the role of keeping the pace fast and urgent, which is an executive role, you know, in state government and in the federal government. There's a talent hunt role, which is to look for always with a determination for people and organizations and ideas to meet community needs. There's the outreach role, which is to find talented staff and to support them and to recruit mayoral appointees in our city, you know, a creature of the progressives. Many, 50 or so citizen commissions, some with great authority, some advisory. There's the listening role, the ears wide open. Oftentimes when you're the chief of staff of anything, you have a yell-y role. And that's especially, I think, vital during budget season. But most of all, it's the make everything work role. And in city government in particular, it's having the capacity to react thoughtfully, and to be proactive wisely.
So never a dull moment for you. Did you get any sleep?
Barely. When I left these mayor's offices after about 5 years each, I remember driving up the coast with my current favorite and only husband, and I, you know, saw every head of lettuce in California. And after a full day, he turned to me and said, "Do you know you haven't said a word for 8 hours?" Yes, it's delightful.
Well, I'm sure you had a lot of really interesting experiences there because, you know, a city like Los Angeles experiences the full gamut of social challenges, and we see that in the news every day. How does Los Angeles promote innovation in developing its public policy and programs? And how did you see that happen as the chief of staff?
Well, you know, it happens in creative with an entrepreneurial mindset. And I think that the mistake that's made in our city hall and other city halls and the halls of government everywhere is to presume that the problems are defined in those buildings and that the solutions are found in those buildings. And we found that by galvanizing the creative energy and different kinds of thinking that exist in our community, and creativity and invention, I like the word invention rather than innovation, comes from many, many different places. And sometimes problems that are addressed in small ways can grow, not scale, but grow thoughtfully. It takes some strategy and thinking and also great resolve. I could think of two examples, one from each mayor, which I think is illuminating. So if I think about Richard Reardon, you know, he was the mayor here during our big massive earthquake. And it was a, you know, as he would say, there wasn't like a mayor's manual on what to do in an earthquake. We'd had practice in response to emergencies of all sorts, unfortunately. But we had some know-how among our police, fire, and emergency service and public works people. But one of the main thoroughfares in our community, the Santa Monica Freeway, or I-10, fell apart. It's a main transportation corridor for commerce, for just work. And the usual path to rebuild was cumbersome. You know, there were state funds and federal funds, and yes, it was an emergency. But meanwhile, our departments, you know, moved transportation one ways all around the freeway, but still it was misery for trying to recover. So Mayor Reardon got the city and state officials literally in a closet and said, you know, I think we need to think about this differently, the awarding of a contract to rebuild. And these are usually slow and cumbersome. He said, I think we need to figure out a way to reward the rebuilding of the freeway fast. And what about if we do a design build? Then an extraordinary new idea. Let's do a design build competition and also have a bonus for the entity that wins if they build on time and under budget. This was like, you must be kidding. The rules don't permit. We've never done it this way. But he galvanized a lot of support in our community and among the decision-making officials up the food chain. And indeed, that's what happened. I had the opportunity to drive on that freeway just when it was, just before it opened. And it was really one of the most joyous days there. Another example would be the way Mayor Villaraigosa had a very tall environmental sustainability agenda. That was one of his priorities. And so he asked that 70 local environmental community organizations gather, some for air, some for water, some for land, and to develop for him, for our administration, an environmental sustainability agenda. And like good enviros everywhere, they argued a lot with one another and eventually came up with a set of recommendations, which the mayor embraced. And to give them legs and feet, the mayor appointed many of these same environmental leaders and placed them in these citizen commissions, important ones, our port, our airport, our water and power, et cetera. And so this was a way to take the ideas, give them legs and feet into the policymaking and execution of new kinds of ways to approach the environment. Instead of shoving all of these concerns into a little department called Environmental Affairs.
It sounds like you are a big fan of citizen engagement in terms of developing effective government solutions. What other sorts of lessons do you draw from your time in city government in terms of the role of government and its effectiveness?
I love working in local government because it is the level of government closest to home. And in pre-COVID days, you know, you'd see your neighbors and they would tell you things in the grocery store and at the library, and there was no flaunting of high rhetoric. Couldn't get away with it, really. What I come away with is that effectiveness comes from this wild and but doable combination of citizen engagement, of ethical leadership, of a sense of urgency, of high ethics, and a willingness, a desire to believe that compromise is a beautiful thing, not an ugly thing, and that it's very difficult to achieve change if you feel you have to do everything. The choice is to do something and to start and to make sure that the voices of communities that have been not heard or unengaged are included at the front end. And the final thing that I think makes government effective is when the combination of people, processes, and policies come together with a forward-looking modern view of what can be, what should be, rather than the rearview mirror thinking of, we've always done it this way, we've never done it this way, and we'll be punished if we try. So I think it's the smorgasbord, the alchemy of all of that, some of which is legislatable and some of which is not.
Who's in which seat has a lot to do with how all of those pieces come together. But that's a really powerful reminder. And now you're out of government. You've worked many years in philanthropy and you've seen how the public sector and philanthropy work together to serve the community. I would love to have you talk about the essential elements really of effective collaboration and partnerships between private sector and philanthropy. How do you get, what seat does philanthropy have in the vision you just laid out for us?
Well, maybe I could, though I am a optimistic, always glass half full person, let me talk a little bit about the glass half empty view of this. One of the challenges is that folks in philanthropy and folks in government don't always know each other. They have ideas about each other, even though they're sort of in the same business. We're both there to, you know, to lift up community life and change lives. As I've seen it, too many in government see foundations as really a giant wallet, lacking in humility, rather clueless and disconnected. But the real truth is that if you know one foundation, you know one foundation. They're like giant human personalities, and you have to get to know them. And on the other side, too many foundation types see government as those folks. They're too slow, they're too bureaucratic, they're too political. And there's this lack of, the chasm is in seeing one another as partners and actors for the public good. I have found that relationships that are true and based on trust and knowledge can come together to discuss and understand a common agenda and define a problem from the various seats where folks, I think there is sometimes in philanthropy, this jump to think about if you do something small, we can help you make it big. We can go to scale without understanding the complexities of making something real happen on the ground. I think foundations have a particular role in community life, and they have wings and feet and responsibility to experiment, to support experimentation, to share knowledge. They know some things too. People in foundations have deep knowledge if they're doing their work around housing or employment or education. They can catalyze. They can bring people together. They can help at the side. They can try stuff that might be difficult for a public official or an entity to try. Well, I would say it this way. Most important, I think, they can help and support those in elected and appointed life who do take risks, responsible risks, and have their backs when it's for the good. There's one thing that foundations do that annoys government types sometimes. I do want to say that, but it's also an important role. And that is that foundations have a responsibility and an opportunity to lift up the voices of those that haven't been heard, those who are vulnerable, and who are working very hard at community change and uplift as they see it, to uplift justice where they see gaps. And sometimes these dissonant voices and voices of criticism and demand annoy people in government very much, but it's part of the beauty of our democracy.
Well, and those are important voices that we've been hearing a lot more from and really having an impact in changing government policy. Can you give us an example from your experience, a specific example where you think government and philanthropy came together in a really effective and powerful way?
Yes, I can think of a recent example, which is a good story and also has the virtue of being true. just as the COVID emergency here began, when we really didn't understand it as well as we do now or its length. Mayor Garcetti, Eric Garcetti, the current mayor of Los Angeles, put together a kitchen table of folks in his office, the mayor's office, the county, because just a reminder, LA City is one of 88 cities in this county of 10.5 million. And the city does what it does, but the county has health and justice, those kinds of activities. We have So the city, the county, and philanthropy, a kitchen table to try and be responsive in a collaborative way to have our efforts converge around meeting emergent needs rather than collide, and to set a way to communicate about that. And during those deliberations, we were able to quickly, sometimes not quick enough, but quickly think about ways to invent and support the respective roles of one another in meeting emergent demands. So just one example, at the very beginning, there was great concern about the ability of first-line workers in hospitals to take care of their own families. They were on call, their childcare was a concern. And through a very good collaborative effort of the three, there were childcare vouchers made available to hospitals and other providers. It was done in a thoughtful, quick way that got help to people who were helping people. The most important thing that came out of this collaboration was probably around April or May. One of the most senior leaders in philanthropy here sort of sat back in his, you know, Zoom chair and said, you know, he happened to be a medical doctor, Bob Ross of the California Endowment. He said, this is going to be a long haul thing. And so here's something that philanthropy could do. The public sector is in the business of response, response, response. They don't have a choice. And every day it's a new mechanism figuring out how to respond. What we could do in philanthropy, we could fund an effort that would be backward looking and forward looking. We could engage research quickly to look ahead. What was done during the pandemic, who was served in our most disadvantaged and vulnerable communities, by whom, why not, how not, and what could be a different pathway ahead. And this report came to be called No Going Back LA. And it was funded by 10 local foundations as a roadmap for our own community here, not just to build back better, but to build back with equity and thoughtfulness. I just say that the conceit of the report is that the research was done because we know all the NAPA folks love data. It was done by UCLA and USC here. And the idea was, if these arch rivals can come together in our town, so can we.
I love that, in the collaboration between the philanthropy, academics, and the public servants to really not just solve the current problem, but plan for the future is inspiring. So I want to keep pulling these two threads about philanthropy and government, especially city government, and talk about unemployment, because it's already such a complex issue. And it's grown exponentially during the COVID crisis. Los Angeles County itself has been hovering around 11% unemployment for the last several months. And I know it's a topic that you are deeply invested in. So let's start by setting the stage. What are the specific challenges associated with getting people either to or back to work in LA?
You know, there's a little bit of context that's also important. There really, I would start to say, there is no system of workforce development here. If you think about a system as being user-friendly, accessible, seamless, effective, there are many islands of many oases in this kind of desert or chaparral, but there's not a user-friendly, obvious system. There were gaps before. And they were just, as you pointed out, made awfully evident and pernicious because of COVID. So there's the structure of the economy here. There was underemployment to start with. We have a very large service sector, and the manufacturing sector has shrunk. Our county, we're the epicenter of inequality. That is the headline here. Essential workers live in overcrowded housing in one of the most expensive housing cities in our country. And so people have gone to work. We have very high labor participation rates, particularly among immigrants. But the lack of education skills that match up with job needs here and job availability, this is a pernicious gap. On top of it, the same USC and UCLA researchers found that many of the younger adults going to community college to access these skills have dropped out of community college to take care of their own families, to tutor their younger siblings, and to maybe go get a job, just to put food on the table. And there's a specific other factor, which is that well over a third of the folks who live here are unauthorized immigrants. So even those public programs that are available for certain kinds of unemployment and help in food security and housing are not available to them. And then on the demand side, different from other communities, we also don't have a well-organized industry set of associations. We don't have strong business associations. They form episodically, and I can tell you about one that's very promising, but this is a historic issue here. We do not have a strong business voice or set of strong business voices here. And then finally, particularly in this employment world, we lack strong intermediary institutions that can connect the dots between need and support and education. We don't have many entities here. There are a few that start with jobs, the job available, the skills needed, and work backwards to the education and training systems that are needed to fill them. There are a few bright spots, but that's the main paintbrush.
It's really tough to think about an integrated workforce strategy, right? From the federal level or the national level all the way down through states and localities. And I think what you're saying there sort of got to my economist mind. And I'm like, there's no market clearing mechanism here to match the demand, as you say, from industry with the supply and to mediate the transactions needed to get employees skills and then skilled employees to the employment opportunities that are available.
Right. That's right. I do think, you know, the way we learn about these is through a lot of digging. There's not a great data source to go find. There are some national entities like the National Fund for Workforce Solutions, which has regional consortia that look at this regionally, that workforce is a regional matter and a collective responsibility. There are some industry groups. One is here, and then I can think of one other. I've come to think that when industry or job sectors have a tremendous pain point, they organize and they do what I just described. We have job needs, we have these skills, we work backwards. A new group that is doing this is called the Building Talent Foundation. They were created by the largest publicly traded home builders. And as I understand it, those home builder executives got together at some point a few years ago and said something like, okay, we could keep complaining to each other about the lack of a skilled workforce to build housing, or we could do something about it. And so they've organized themselves. Similarly, here in Los Angeles, a group of high technology, Digital Coast, we call it, folks, same kind of a thing. We have a pain point. Many of our markets are young and people of color. Our workforce is not. What are we going to do about it? So they came together similarly. But these are the kinds of entrepreneurial ground-up efforts I know of. There's no easy or even differentiated system that makes it easy for a person who even thinks about something new to figure out where to go to, how to raise a hand, and who's never met anyone like that to talk to begin.
Yeah. You know, it may seem a little esoteric when so many people just want a job to talk about getting meaningful work, but that is one of the Academy's grand challenges, connecting individuals to meaningful work. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts kind of building on what we're just talking about. How do we move beyond thinking that just connecting people to a job is important to the point where connecting people to meaningful work is actually the root problem?
You know, I think about it this way, and it's not an original thought. You know, we try and rip off good ideas wherever we can. So this one comes in the form of teaching from a man named Elliot Washer, who founded a now 30-year-old organization, Leadership Education, organization. He says, you know, you start with a young person or an older person's interest, not what do you want to be with what you grow up? What do you care about? And to follow that care with exposure to that world and to give younger people and people in mid-career or wanting to switch an experience, insight into what the world of that work might look like. If you've never met someone who's a chef, you might think, oh, that culinary thing, that sounds fantastic. But the work of becoming a chef and the likelihood of earning a living wage, tough, very tough. We think about meaningful work as work that is pays a family wage, a sustainable life, and is fulfilling, where a person could say, this is my work, whatever it is, and I make a difference. I make a difference.
I can feel your enthusiasm for this, like through the screen. And so I want to dig down one more level, because now at the Smith Foundation, you focus on a specific aspect of preparing individuals for meaningful work. So tell us about the Harbor Freight Tools for Schools program and how it got started.
It started out of the same kind of belief. Eric Smith himself, you know, high school graduate, did not go to college, hated school, and was not meant to feel like a smart guy in high school. And so when he built this business, which is still family owned, it's a very successful business, and he had a few nickels to rub together, began to think, well, what's the way that we could make a difference, that I could help make a difference for kids like me, who good with their hands, love to work, school, eh. And at the same time, looks around and sees, you know, there are literally millions of jobs in our country sitting vacant for lack of skilled work. And yet there's a lot of rhetoric about the virtue of hard work and what built our country. And there's some kind of gaps here. And that's how Harbor Freight Tools for Schools started. It began with a donation of what ended up being $1.4 million worth of tools to skilled trades classrooms in the LA school district, which ended up being only in adult schools because those programs had exited high schools here. There are barely any left. And what happened was that anyone who's ever worked with schools could have predicted, which is that there was no inventory control for the school, for the tools. The teacher who had ordered them had been promoted and gone downtown. There was no one to meet the large truck full of tools. So the company set about, because they believed in this, to make it right. And that's when the modern part of Harbor Freight Tools for Schools started, with the idea that, well, tools can help kids in skilled trades in high schools succeed, but it's not the way to start. You have to start with teachers, learn more about the sector, learn what's happened to all these courses, what could be a solution to the gap between the need for skilled workers and their opportunities, and the lack of a pipeline that might lead there, or give students a chance to experience what modern shop craft is like, not some version of the old, nuanced, dirty, racist, for someone else's kids kind of version. That's how we began.
Well, you know, I got my start in the military as a maintenance officer, so I love this. I'm very attuned to your idea of inventory and, you know, control and training and the opportunities that are available here. So I'm a big fan of the program myself. Talk a little bit about how now you move through execution. How do you identify partners that you work with to help bring this kind of education into the schools?
We started with teachers. We started over not, you know, there's a lot of people who've worked in public education and tried to provide support. My experience, particularly having worked for those two hard-charging mayors in Los Angeles, neither of whom had authority over schools, but believed that as went schools, so went cities, as went cities, so went schools. You know, a lot of times there was this idea that you went by industry or whomever, you bring together a perfect package, you give it to the teachers, and they will implement. This is a failed strategy. So we started a different place. We started by listening. We listened to teachers in the skilled trades in public high schools. We asked them what their life was like, what their students were like, how they learned, how they recruited new, what the challenges to the sector were, if and how they connected to jobs and industry leaders. And we built from that a strategy to listening to them to offer $1 million prize each year for skilled trades excellence in public high school. $1 million. So the top winners of this prize, through a very rigorous, engaging process, the top winners win $100,000, Terry, $70,000 for their program, and $30,000 for them, just like the MacArthur Genius Awards. And all of this is really just the beginning of a sort of Trojan horse to bring these exceptional teachers together, not a one and done. They meet every summer through a thing we invented called Let's Build It, to lift up their own skill in invention, to meet one another and have a community of practice, and to build more for the field. So we're building knowledge, human capital, and learning as we go. And the way we find partners is we do a lot of research. We read a lot. We look for where they're, we listen to the teachers and their practice. We look at governors, states of the union. We try to understand funding and mechanisms and public support. And we look for data, but it was tough to find. We look for, you know, like NAPA, as I mentioned, we love data, but we couldn't find much. We couldn't find much that was germane, or it was very dated.
So you commissioned some reporting about that, right?
We did. We commissioned two reports. One was to understand the landscape of skilled trades in public high schools in America. This was done by Jobs for the Future. And a second opinion research by NORC at the University of Chicago to ascertain the views of voters and students and parents about skilled trades in public high schools for my kids, for all kids, for our community. And we did so really because we couldn't find data. And it turned out it was still pretty tough to find. 37 of the 50 states responded, only a few of them completely. And big data gaps they had. We all know in government, you know, you are what you measure. You only measure what you can control. There was not a lot of measurement going on. It means there wasn't a lot of valuing of this sector.
Well, I know when I was working on veterans employment programs in the Department of Labor, so many of the companies and industry were desperate to hire veterans because they had these kinds of trades. And it was a matter of just maybe adding on the next certification to bring them up to current private sector standards. But what did your reports tell you about the willingness of students and families of high schoolers to pursue this kind of training? It seems clear that there's a real market for it, and wage and salary data would tell you that it's one of those meaningful work, family sustaining sorts of income levels, but you've got to get a supply out there. What does that look like?
Well, the opinion research was, in that respect, surprising to us, because when you're inside the bubble of working with, you know, CTE, career and technical education, educators and their supporters, there is a view we are stigmatized, no one loves us, you know, it's tough to recruit. These are the kind of what you hear. And I think that is a real feeling. But the survey research showed incredible, like 70, 80% respect, support for the skilled trades in public high schools. Incredible, strong agreement about their value. And it came on both sides of the aisle, urban and rural, men and women. There was big support for the idea that students who learn with their hands and can take that learning into real work and bring it back, that was valuable for those young people, whatever they were going to do in life. But the research also found huge gaps between the courses that are being offered in high schools, the jobs that are available. Just like in the rest of public education, there's a shortage of teachers. And if the current man, the most of the teachers are male and older, if they retired, they kind of had to recruit their own replacement, or the program might not go forward. The findings were a good start. It was such a slog to get the data. And we thought we might do this every year, but, you know, your hair would go gray twice if one were to go at that pace. I will say that one of the hopeful signs is in those high schools, for the student panels, in those high schools where the skilled trades were just offered, whether a young person took those courses or not, respect grew. A feeling of importance grew. So proximity mattered. There's something we learned recently, not from these studies, but I think of importance now. Many high school students have parents that maybe were involved in advanced manufacturing or the trades. And when the economic downturn occurred in 2008 and they lost their jobs. So now they're the parents and they may be saying to their kids, we're not certain about this. Mm-hmm. We have a lived experience which signals caution. So this is something we want to learn more about.
Really interesting. Well, I think there's about to be a big topic on the national debate stage that will raise the profile of the importance of trades. And that's if the next stimulus bill really focuses on infrastructure building to promote national economic recovery. It's going to create economic opportunity and it's going to create demand for skilled trades. So what policy would you hope to see maybe in that bill or around that bill that would both create the jobs and help connect individuals to them?
Well, that's exactly it. I just would say I spent a little bit of time in what turned out so far to be a cul-de-sac venture, several webinars about infrastructure in California and resilient infrastructure and all this. High school's not mentioned. My whole aim was to think, well, we have some data that shows and blah, blah, blah. So my hope would be that there, first of all, would be a connection between the human infrastructure needed to build, support, repair, and that on the infrastructure side, there would be also a focus on not just traditional, which are important, so roads and bridges and highways, but also the natural environment, care for the natural environment, broadband. There's a way that connecting communities of need with employment to address community needs that are targeted and local. Sometimes there is not a connection between the human infrastructure and training and that magic word, infrastructure. As a city person, a second thing, I think that flipping the paradigm would be a beautiful thing. And by that, I mean, instead of having a federal policy, it's my own view only, instead of having a federal policy with the national infrastructure and many different layers of bureaucracy to the city, to the state, to the city, why not start with examples of not just shovel ready, but a new definition of shovel ready that comes from locales with flexibility from the federal government, flexibility and speed? That would make a huge difference in the nature of policymaking about investments in infrastructure. If there's federal dollars involved, good wages are paid, and that goes without saying. So all else follows. But if there's not, thoughtful training connects, whether it's place-based, poverty-based, community-based, we'd miss a huge and real opportunity beyond the rhetoric.
Well, Robin, I want to thank you for sharing your insights with us and for the great work you are doing at this really important and complicated intersection of connecting individuals to meaningful work. It's just been a delight to chat with you today. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
For our listeners, check back every Monday for a new podcast from the Academy. We'll be talking to Academy Fellows each week about the challenges facing public administrators at every level of government as we try to make government work and work for all. Thanks for listening.